It was either meditation or medication because life was very challenging. It was a sort of a no-win situation outside world. And the only journey that was left for me was to the inside.
As brilliant as we can be, the innovations that we make, the way that we can get one machine to fly from one spot in the earth to the other, Mother Nature really has the final say. Then Mother Nature's like, you know what? You guys are gonna stay indoors while you sort this out. And we've really had to be forced into going inward.
As women, and by women, I'm referring to nurturing, mothering energy. It somehow implies if somebody is suffering, it must be my responsibility to make it okay. If you make somebody's journey, your life journey, and really go out of your way to change it for them, you cannot move their journey one day. But when I say I'll do what I can to support what you want to do, now I'm in a zone that I can do something and I can ask you, you know, you tell me, Jamie, what are you going? Oh, you're doing that. Would you like some help? No, it's a different story. So I sat there, I said, what is it? And I literally imagined my experience as a person. I poured like a crazy person, tea for it and tea for me. And then suddenly I realized I'm relaxing and my whole body is just completely present. When a baby is born, everybody is happy, but the baby cries. When somebody is leaving, everybody is crying and the person is smiling. Then you have a different relationship with ending of things. You can end better, cleaner.
Welcome back to The Ginny Show. And joining me is a fellow sister who was born in the East and raised in the West, quite like myself. Mitra Manesh, welcome to The Ginny Show.
Thank you, Jeannie.
I love the fact that I get to speak to someone who's had a similar experience as me. I was born in the East, born in Sri Lanka, only lived there for 2.5 years and then moved to the West in Melbourne, Australia. That's why I have my adorable accent. But today's show is all about you and I can't wait to dive into who you are and what you do, Mitra. I'd first like to ask you what your story is of how you were introduced to mindfulness and mindful living. Do you mind sharing a little bit about that?
Actually, I landed in mindfulness. That's not so much introduced to it. This all happened in the 80s, early 80s, when I had basically lost my country. I was born in Iran and literally walked out of Iran when the war started, when Khomeini came and then war between Iran and Iraq started. So I walked out and lived in Europe for a while, then moved to Australia. So your accent is quite familiar, feels at home. I have 2 Aussie kids. And over there, I always say, and it sounds like it's a cute statement, but it's true. It was either meditation or medication because life was very challenging. If I had a good time, I was living in Perth at that time. If I had a good time, I would feel guilty because everybody was like in war and they couldn't find food. And if I had a bad time, I would say, what am I doing here? So it was a sort of a no-win situation outside world. And the only journey that was left for me was to the inside. And you have to understand, I'm in my 20s at that time. Mm. And inward I went. And boy, oh boy, did I ever discover an amazing world that I felt empowered because outside it was completely out of my control. But when I went in, I felt a sense of being in charge of how I'm feeling and how connected I can be with what's going on.
Wow. So mindfulness and mindful living was a consequence as opposed to an intentional thing that happened.
Exactly. I wish I could tell you I was sitting one day and I got enlightened and I thought I should do that. No, I don't have that story. I was sort of like banging into life and I thought, okay, this is out of my control. There's nothing I can do. Let me see if I can do something different. So that's how I started my mindfulness journey. And I had many, many paths to it. It's not just one path, but that's what happened in the 80s.
I love how you've talked about going inward. At the time of recording this, we're all, the world is experiencing the pandemic that is COVID-19. And what I find particularly interesting around this time is human beings, and I think there is a Hindu teaching about this too, where can't remember the actual deity, but finding the source or the elixir of life. The teaching was, you know, put it in a mountain and then the god deity was like, no, humans will find a way to climb it, put it in the sea, humans will find a way to dive into the ocean and find it. But if you put it within, that's when the human being will struggle. And I find that such a beautiful teaching. But as applicable as that story is to this time, as brilliant as we can be, the innovations that we make, the way that we can get one machine to fly from one spot in the earth to the other, Mother Nature really has the final say, like with what happens. And Mother Nature's like, you know what? You guys are going to stay indoors while you sort this out. And we've really had to be forced into going inward. And how are you coping during this pandemic, Mitra? How have you found people and your clients to be showing up during this time?
It's very interesting. First of all, I saw a picture, it wasn't mine, that was very telling. On one side was the picture of COVID, which is like the smallest species you can tell. And then on the other side was this huge jet. It was like, you know, an airplane. And then there was an article about how, and they weren't going there, but my mind went there. Just comparison of this tiniest element with this gigantic, you know, airplane at the back of it, these high-rise buildings. It's really interesting. It's all about power, not about the size. And I think the West needs to remember that. So that's one thing. And you had a few questions. Well, how am I coping and what am I seeing? I actually have been far more active. I have a lot of online classes through UCLA that I'm teaching, some free and some, you know, ongoing. And I'm also seeing clients regularly. It's really amazing that whatever was inside of people has come out and it's showing. Nothing new is happening. Nothing new, especially people that I knew from before. So I'm not shocked to see what I'm seeing. It's just, it's been put under microscope. It's like when the push comes and I sort of like put you in the corner, the real you comes out. That's why there's a saying in all old cultures where you and I come from, that you want to know somebody, just travel with them because you take them out of their comfort zone. I no longer am in my, you know, kingdom that I can, or queendom in this case, that I can do whatever I want and see how I'm doing. So that's what I'm seeing. I'm seeing whatever was in there, and by in there is like inside of people, that they were hiding through being busy. They were hiding by being positive, whatever that means, by being kind. And there are so many cover-ups by being a professional. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have so many cover-ups that we have. And that has come true and it's showing up. And for myself, it's true too. It's really interesting that I've moved in with my 88-year-old mother. And I saw that a lot of things that I thought have been resolved, they had not been resolved. Mm-hmm. So it's a beautiful opportunity that I now am in a better place, I hope, than where I was when I was younger. And I'm actually resolving and dissolving a lot of things from my end through compassion and through truly being at her service. I mean, I'm serving my mother. And I mean that in every sense. I mean that in the, you know, physical sense. I'm cooking and serving her. And I am serving her emotionally and serving myself as a result.
Amazing. When you said that you literally walked out of Iran, you said literally you walked out of Iran. Did your mother accompany you or were you not together?
No, we weren't together at that time. No, I had been to US as a student, and when the war started, they closed the doors and only if you had permission to leave, you could leave. So based on my student visa that I had, I was allowed to leave, but there were no planes and we had no ticket. So I took a bus to the border of Iran and Turkey. And I mean, there's a whole story there, but that's another podcast. One day we'll talk about that. But we had no idea. I mean, there was a whole bus full of people. We had no idea what would be waiting for us. So we walked over to the other border, hoping that someone, because it's in the middle of nowhere, hoping that a bus would come and pick us up, which eventually it happened. But that's what I meant. And my luggage was just as big as any bag that I use on a daily basis here. So I did not bring anything with me. All my contacts, all my possessions, everything that I had been accustomed to, I had to leave and start all over again. So this is not that unusual of experience, even though one of my students reminded me very smartly. She said, you had a place to go to. We have no place to go to. We have no place to go to right now. I said, but eventually I found out it wasn't the place out there that was really giving me refuge. It was the place here
within
that gave me the refuge. Yeah.
Wow. That's beautifully said. One thing that you also said too, when you were in Perth, when things were going well, there was this guilt that you felt. And when things were going poorly, you felt like, oh gosh, what am I doing? I find this to be a common internal dialogue with women, especially women who are on the way to achieving a thriving career, a thriving life, relationships, health. Because I believe that in this day and age, it's the opportunity for women to have the big three. Previous generations, I know my mother didn't have the opportunities I did. I know my grandmother didn't. So for me to be able to have access to all three possibilities is quite profound. How did you mitigate that internal dialogue, Mitra? Because clearly you've done okay for yourself. Like clearly you're empowered, you're teaching people to be mindful. How did you mitigate that internal dialogue? Because that guilt can be really, it can be crippling.
It can be, yes. As women, and by women, I really am not talking about gender. I usually talk about energies as opposed to just gender, because there are a lot of masculine bodies that take the role of the feminine role. But I'm referring to nurturing, mothering energy that is given to us. It somehow implies, and it's very subtle at some stages and sometimes very, very overt, that we need to be taking care of people. And if somebody is suffering, it must be my responsibility to make it okay. Where I made amends with that, when I made friends with that, is when I really realized that there is a triangular about life. And I have a very specific relationship with threes because that's to me the trinity of life. But it's the genes that I bring to this world. It is the environment that I grow up in, which sounds great. But then there is a free will that allows me to really, these are the ingredients. And then you become the chef and you go to the kitchen and you cook whatever you cook, talking about feminine energy. Yeah. Here I am cooking already.
You had me at food. So it's a great way to get my attention, Mitra.
I love cooking and I love food. So there you go. So it's like, I realized that there is really nothing. And this was a beautiful statement that one of my teachers told me a long time ago. He said, if you make somebody's journey, your life journey, and really go out of your way to change it for them, you cannot move their journey one day. I mean, that's a powerful statement. And that's when I resigned. And I'm literally meaning I wrote a letter to myself and I wrote my full name. And I quite often ask my clients to do the same, that I, Mitra Mimesh, on this 14th of May, 2020, hereby resign from the position of being responsible for the happiness and wellness of other people. However, when you do that, it sounds like very selfish. It's like, really? You don't care? Actually, when I do that, I am capable and able to do what I can because I'm pursuing an impossibility when I want to change your life. But when I say I'll do what I can to support what you want to do, now I'm talking practicality and doability. Now I'm in a zone that I can do something and I can ask you, you know, you tell me, Jeannie, what are you going? Oh, you're doing that. Would you like some help? How can I help? Now it's a different story. It is now your agenda to change and go there. And it's my agenda to support, not the other way around.
Yeah. There's a request put in and permission granted as opposed to involuntarily or doing it in an obligatory way.
Yes. And I've taken your free will away from you, even at the best of times. I mean, I ask for permission to hold people in my meditation and prayer. And they always say like, well, of course. So no, of course. You may not like that for me to have you, your energy and your, you know, my awareness on you. Some people don't like it. So even the best of acts and best of intentions always need permission because there is a free will at work at any given time. Do you really want me to do this? And the example I give my clients, they say, no, I don't understand that. I say, what if I showed up at your door at 6 a.m. tomorrow morning? And they say, what? I said, well, you come to me, you make an appointment, you park your car, you pay my fee. What if I showed up? Wouldn't you freak out? They say, yeah, it would be freaky. I say, okay. Why? Because you didn't ask for it.
So. Wow. So the element of free will, do you feel is being unconsciously kind of disregarded in some sense? It's being carelessly used.
Exactly. In the name of love and care. You know, I love you and I care for you. And that's when we actually break boundaries and go to places. And you see, and it happens, I know I come from a culture that is very traditional in its essence, and it looks modern to the world, but it's quite traditional. And that permission is always there. It's just like, but I thought I should take care of you. So I did not ask for that. But however, I would like you to do this one. Can you carry this? Because I've planned for that myself. So that sense of permission, even when it's the most loving thing we can do, I always say the most loving thing is the most liberating thing. When I ask you, how can I help you? I've liberated you and myself from being the decision maker in your life. Of course, we're talking about adults. I'm not talking about underage children.
Of course, of course. So the most loving thing you can do is often the most liberating thing that you can do.
Absolutely.
It's fantastic. It's like a notebook for me virtually. This is great. Mitra, one of the interviews you did recently on technology for mindfulness, there's something that you said, which was really quite profound, is about visiting the past and future. And you said that it's important to visit the past and future, but only with a visitor's past and a strict itinerary. Now, the adventurous side of me gets very excited about that. Would you mind expanding on that? Why is it important to visit the past and the future in this sort of way with a strict itinerary? It's like going to a country and there's some laws in place, but you've got to follow it. Can you expand upon that for me?
So what happens is, as I teach, and I've been teaching for over 35 years now, I see that all the troubles of my people and my own, they reside either in the past or in the future. So I'm either sad, and an extreme of it is depression, which means I'm visiting the past too often, or I'm too anxious about the future, which means I'm staying in the future too often. So when I say that, everybody says, oh, so, and usually I'm teaching in a corporate or educational setting. These are goal-getters who have things to do. So they say, so are you saying we should never, ever pay attention to the past or future? I'm saying, no, you need to do it with awareness. Why do I go to the past? Past is good for one thing, and that is to learn lessons. That's a great way of going to the past. I either want to know what worked so I can do it again, or what didn't work so I can like learn from that. So I call it, you go to the past for lamenting, but really it's a different L. It's for learning.
Ah, okay. You go to the past for learning. Okay.
For learning and learning what works, and it was happy, and visiting something good. But if you stay too long, even if it's something good that you're visiting, I'm saying, oh, it was such a great interview. I really enjoyed it. But immediately my suffering comes because it finished. Mm-hmm. It went to an end. So now something good turned into something that I'm lamenting and not happy about. So eventually it becomes the lamenting, either the having of it or not having of it.
Right.
So what do? I take, and I say, we are the really the residents and the citizens of the now. But we really are here.
Wow.
We really are here. When I get a visa to go to the past, what happens? Imagine you and I go to a country and there's a visa. Well, first of all, there's expiry. You know, they've given us for 30 days or 20 days. And secondly, we know what we're doing. I don't just show up in Sweden and I have no idea middle of the night where I'm going.
Yeah.
And if we do apply that to visiting the past, then I go there and I say, you know, I really want to know, how did I do in this interview? Something very simple. I'm not even going for like love relationship. How right. did I do? I want to see this. I just asked you, can I record this? I want to see how I did. Can I do it better? Can I be more present? So I go to the past, but I immediately come back to my place of citizenship, which is the now. And for the same thing for the future. If we didn't plan, you and I, we wouldn't be having this conversation. Mm. But if I overplanned, when my planning goes from planning to overplanning to overplanning and now overplanning, now I'm anxious. Oh my God, what is she going to ask me? What if I don't do well? What if it's bad? Like now I'm like lost it. But if I went enough to rearrange my day and do a bit of research, as you've done research about me, I've done research about you, like what's going on, what kind of questions, what kind of answers, right. Then I'll relax. I'll get back to the present. Okay. This is good. This is where I belong.
So we are citizens and residents of the present, but it seems like we're constantly chasing visas for the past and the future.
Future. An extreme of future is anxiousness. So we go to the future to worry, but we want to wonder. It's a different W, different L.
So in the essence of curiosity, obviously we want to wonder about the future, but it creates both the past and the future create some element of suffering, which takes us out of the now. Exactly. Is what you're trying to say. Okay.
Exactly. Especially when we overstay our visa.
Yeah. And that leaves a whole heap of trouble, doesn't it? Even in the literal sense. We get into a lot of trouble with that.
The Genie Show. The Genie Show. Our lonely days are gone.
I'm curious to know too, what was the time that you actually instituted that theory of visiting the past with a strict itinerary and the same for the future as well? What kind of created that for you? Was there an experience that happened?
Many experiences. I remember, so many comes to mind. I remember that I felt I'm more of a past visitor because usually we have a tendency and sometimes we have both. We have worrying and sadness, which is the worst of both worlds.
Yeah.
I remember one thing. It was about a decision that I had made, a financial decision that I had made. You know, once you lose everything, losing becomes easier, actually, believe it or not. For me, I mean, I can pack up anytime and go lightly anywhere. But this was a particular thing that I was attached to and I had lost it. And I realized that my mind, I mean, when you start really paying attention what your mind does, I always say to my students, if you think out loud when you're in the car and nobody's there, you will never call anybody crazy ever again because the craziest person lives right up here.
Absolutely.
And it's going randomly everywhere. And I just could not help myself going back. And I remember I took a couple of days off and I said, this can't be. I'm able to do so many things. Why can't I do this? And I thought, maybe there's something there for me. That's why I go there. There must be some substance there for me. Mm-hmm. And I realized, I said, okay, let me, and I was not fluent in the language of mindfulness, to be honest with you. I was just curious. I was very curious. I'm still very curious about this journey called life. So I sat there, I said, what is it? And I literally imagined my experience as a person. And I said, let's sit there. I poured like a crazy person, tea for it and tea for me. And I said, here, tell me what you want to tell me. And then suddenly I realized I'm relaxing and my whole body is just completely present. And in learning come, and I'm thinking, oh, there's a third guest. So it was my past. It was me. And then there is a new guest sitting here. It's like, whoa, I needed to learn that. And my inner wisdom knew that. So I go there. It's a misguided wisdom, basically. A lost wisdom. I know I need to go there, but I don't know why. I think I'm there to lament and say, oh, it was so good. You don't know. And it gets exaggerated. I don't know. If you see, I only talk about my people. If you saw Persians after Iranians after revolution, everybody exaggerated what they had in Iran. We all had palaces and we all had, you know, 18 this and 20 that. It's like, no, it's not true. We didn't have those. We had the average lives, you know, at least I did.
Right.
But you know what I'm saying? My exaggerated mind was going back there. It knew there was some wisdom to it, but it was just misguided. So I was looking for something else and hence coming back unhappy. But when I invited it and I said, tell me what you want to tell me. Here you are. Here's your tea. Here's my tea. I have a whole day. Tell me. And then I realized a new beautiful fruit and flower was coming out, and that was the learning. So that's where it came from. And I said, okay, if there's something for the past, there must be something for the future. And I call it light planning. Of course, we need to do light planning. And that's where it came from.
I love this concept of, it's kind of like having tea with your present self, your future self, and your past self. And there's wisdom in each self, so to speak. But it's really the present self that, for want of a better way of looking at it from what you're saying, Mitra, is the present self that we should always return to and always remain as much as possible there. So I just love what you said, because I do see in people when they reminisce for too long, it creates a suffering or a sense of lack. Or if they hope for something too much and it doesn't happen, again, it creates a suffering and a sense of lack. But in the present, it kind of neutralizes the experience because it's actually not happening in their minds. It's beautiful. I love that teaching. One person that you're a fan of is Rumi. I'm a big fan of Rumi too. He's my spiritual homeboy, as I like to call him. What is your favorite Rumi quote, teaching, and why?
Rumi talks about death, and I'm fascinated by experience of death. In fact, I taught a class, 6-week class, believe it or not, people came and talked about
death.
About death. And he says there's
market a good that. Sorry to interrupt you. How do you market a class on death? Let's learn about death.
Let's get it over and done with, because that's our hidden fear anyway.
Yeah.
That's what's really running the whole show, except it's hidden and it's in a fearful way. Once, exactly like that, once I have tea with it, then I can just get it over and done with.
Mm.
There's a line that Rumi says, I am not leaving, I am arriving at eternal love. So thinking death is leaving, and he says, I am not leaving, I am arriving at eternal love. And that explains death for me. We have come from a place of unity and oneness. And to me, dying, physical dying, because energy never dies, it always changes forms. But energy, that which animates this body, called Mitra, is never, ever going to die. The dish will die, but the food inside it, the energy inside it, will never die. Mm-hmm. So when I think about arriving at eternal love, that really summarizes my experience of death. And I really hope that when I go with that message and with a smile on my face.
Wow.
That's why it's important to me. Because the most powerful fear that we have is fear of death. That's why ending anything is hard for us. Because ending reminds us at subconscious level of death. So this relationship is not working. I still can't end it. Parties, I'm there, I'm tired, I need to go home, but I feel, believe it or not, we're always feeling death in things, anything that comes to an end. And that's why that is the most powerful fear that subconsciously is ruling us. Once we figure that out, as much as one can, it's not like you figure it out.
Yeah.
But you somehow amend and you somehow befriend it. Then you realize that life is actually quite delicious.
Nobody's explained death to me that way, because I was thinking, and I say this aloud a lot of the time, I say to people, I haven't really lost someone close to me. Like, my parents are thankfully still alive. My grandparents, I wasn't that close to. And obviously I was sad when the one that was alive when I was around passed. But I found a complete paradox in my ability to cope with loss, in terms of losing a friendship or a relationship or a job or a circuit. It's different. I'm like, yeah, I haven't lost anybody close to me, but the way I behave when these things end is like I'm going through the worst thing in the world. So I can really resonate with that we experience death in things. That's so profound.
In things and with people, in relationships, in losing things. I mean, people lose something small and it's like, but this is okay. You know, you can replace it, but it's that death experience. And by the way, when we have such a strong fear, we're dying so many times out of the fear. So the experience itself, and I've been, I mean, it's going to get a little bit morbid for people who are not used to this. I've been in rooms when people leave this world, for some reason, many people request it, and I hold the place when they're leaving. And it's really fascinating what I see. Here's a very interesting observation I've had. When a baby is born, everybody is happy, but the baby cries when he or she arrives. When somebody is leaving, everybody is crying.
Wow.
And the person is smiling.
Never thought of it that way. That is a fascinating observation. What a paradox. There's suffering on some end.
And going home at other end.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we're going, I mean, it sounds like it's a religion. It's not. It's like we're really going home. Going home. And anyway, so what I wanted to say is that when we have that fear, and when that fear is always there, we actually suffer far more. When we understand death at any level, either scientifically, I have a lot of scientific clients, or at spiritual level, or at just practical level, maybe metaphysical level, then you have a different relationship with ending of things.
Mm.
Anything. things that are experiencing that are pleasant and those that are unpleasant. You can end better, cleaner.
Wow. I'm going to play this podcast in my morning practice mitra because, you know, it will remind me of these things. This is fascinating. Speaking of morning practice, you seem like a very self-sourced woman. Clearly you hold space to be there for people quite a lot, especially during these times. And, you know, you're there for your mother and serving your mother. How do you start your day?
I have a very specific ritual. It's actually quite Ayurvedic ritual. I do oil pulling. That's the first thing in the morning that I do.
Oil pulling? What's that?
Oil pulling. Okay, so I put actually coconut oil. The idea is that the bacteria in the mouth really thrives when it's dark, when it's wet. And it's dark and wet at night. And that's why in the morning, our mouth smells a little bit.
Yeah.
So, or sometimes more than a little bit. So the idea is that nothing can wash it away. So oil pulls it out. And the way you do it, I just put a spoon of coconut oil in my mouth and I gargle as I'm doing other things and then throw it out and scrape the tongue and then I wash it. So that's the first thing I do. And then I get my water and lime, not lemon, lime, and a bit of sea salt. And that's the second thing I do to cleanse the body because it's been, you know, really not working. You want to just imagine you're refreshing it with lime water. And cleansing it. And then, of course, it's my meditation practice. I mean, I know it's fashionable and they call it, what do they call it? Intermittent fasting. But I have been doing that for a long time because my teacher used to eat only once a day. And I learned from him. And I eat just for certain hours and the rest, I'll just have hot tea and just drinks, but not food for digestion. So that's my day.
What oil pulling? I'm going to have to look into that too. Yeah. So it's coconut oil and a little bit of
water. I use coconut oil. Yeah, I use like organic coconut oil and just like a teaspoon. I put it in your mouth and it just melts and you just like gargle it. And what the idea is, and you should really throw it out, not even in the sink, in the trash can, because there's a lot of bacteria in it. It literally pulls out. And then you scrape the tongue and you will see, well, you will see, I'm not going to be vivid here. And then you brush your teeth. And
it's,
I believe it's been protecting me from getting a lot of viruses. I'm exposed to people. I mean, I go to UCLA. There are usually a lot of young people there. And right. and I see a lot of clients. So I'm very much in contact with people. But I very rarely get sick. In fact, I can't remember the last time that I got sick. So
wow. Wow. That's amazing. Mitra, you talk very fondly about your teacher. I don't know if you speak about him quite publicly, but he's obviously a big impact, as all teachers are to us. But my many spiritual teachers in a body and not in a body impact me profoundly. Tell me a little bit about your teacher, how you came connected to him, and if you are willing to share.
First of all, when I say teacher, I'm referring to bodies of teaching. This is very important. But one particular body comes to mind because I don't think it's about teachers. I think it's about teachings that is important. And I had teachers since I was a child. However, and you hear that, I have an app, as I'm sure you know, and a lot of teachings that I do is through stories, and my teachers come in my stories. But the teacher that I was talking about, he was a Buddhist monk from Thailand. And the way I got to know him was actually when I was doing service. I had a friend, and it was his 50th birthday. I was living in Toronto, Canada. He was not in a good place. And we all got together and tried to do a birthday, surprise birthday party for him. I had heard that he had talked about one of his friends when he lived in India as a very, very fond friend. And he talked about him very, you know, fondly. So to surprise him, I found this teacher. He was the head monk at one of the monasteries in California, outside of Los Angeles. And then I was living in Toronto. So anyways, long story short, I fly this monk to my home to take him for the surprise birthday party. Lo and behold, he sits in my car and I realize I'm in the presence of a teacher. And we bond almost immediately. The gift that was supposed to be for my friend became the biggest gift of my life. And we bonded and he became my teacher. And I traveled with him and I stayed in contact with him. And so on and so forth. So a lot of teachings came from him.
Amazing. What would you say has been the biggest heartprint he's left on you?
Oh, the biggest one was to have fun. I traveled with this 80-something, 90-year-old man, a Buddhist monk. Honestly, it was like traveling with a 9-year-old kid. We were laughing and giggling and like, it was fun. And I thought like, really? I thought like I had to sit like this and just like, shh, be quiet. The guy was like the funnest person I had ever met.
Yeah.
Everything I said, it's like, he would laugh and we would giggle. And I thought like, okay, so depth doesn't mean like sadness and this like, you know, whatever it is, like people think it is.
Yeah.
It was just the funnest thing I had ever experienced. And I learned so much. You know, I would get my paper and pen out and say like, what questions can I ask him? It was like, honestly, it was like when I was playing with my brother as a kid. That's how I felt like. Fun, playfulness. Fun.
Right.
And even you know, I know you were waiting for something profound.
Yeah, I thought you'd
the most profound thing I learned.
I thought you were going to drop some Rumi on me there, Mitra. That was not what I expected, but I love that because we forget to have fun as adults. We lose our childlike element. We're so caught up in responsibility that we forget to have fun. I think I try to laugh once a day, at least. But, you know, it does happen more. But that's a very small goal to have. I will expand upon that. But also, right. Laughter is contagious, right? It spreads and it's so important to have fun. I love that. Mitra, I guess like it's been an absolute pleasure having this time with you and spending this time with you. I just feel like I've had another morning meditation and it's the middle of my day or the end of my day. But I'm curious to know too, obviously during this time, levels of anxiety have increased, depressions happen. Like you said, what has been really hidden and avoided within us has just reared its ugly head and is staring at us in the face. And a lot of people are feeling very helpless in how to deal with that. What are some suggestions that you have for people who are really struggling at the moment, especially with COVID-19 and what it's kind of forced us all to do?
So I answer that question in two realms. One is the inner way and one is the outer, what to do and how to be, because they're two different things. So what to do, I always talk about increasing capacity. And that's a very practical practice. You've seen people not be able to do things and then all of a sudden they're doing that thing plus 20 other things. Mm. I mean, as a single young person, like we can hardly take care of ourselves and then we have a partner and then we have a family and then we are working full time. And suddenly the same person is able to do far more even though the body is aging. So what is that? Obviously, there is a hidden capacity that we have not tapped into. My invitation to people is to just get curious about that capacity. And I don't know what that is for everybody, but I always say, do not make that a period. This is difficult. It is challenging times. We don't know what's going to happen, but this is not a period. This is a comma, I can find a way. I can handle it. And I don't know what that is, but I know that I can. When I look within, I can find it. So from doing, we going inside and saying, what else can I do? What else can I tap into that I haven't tapped into it? But in the practical sense, I really invite people to create some time for themselves. I divided the process, and it's really a process of mourning. We've lost something and it's a collective loss that we're experiencing. We went to initial shock, which is very normal. Without it, we will not survive. If I don't understand, if my body doesn't go like this, I won't stop when a car, you know, turns in front of me. But if I stay in this state, then I'm always sick and always anxious. So let's divide the process into three stages and see if that works for us. Initial stage shock, really surprise, and anger, whatever it is, loss. The second one is the contemplation. Let's go in and see what's going on for me. Why am I experiencing this? And people talk about the politics of it and other things. And I'm saying, it doesn't matter who did it. For me, I'm saying, in my lifetime, I'm experiencing this. There must be something in it for me that I haven't got. It doesn't matter who did it. It's not about fault. It's about like I'm here. So the second step is contemplation. And the third step is what I call realization and wise action. It's from this process that I can actually decide what to do. So we need to go through the heart first, feel our emotions, to the head then, and you know, decide what's going on. And then from putting it together, then we come up with. I call it head, heart, hand, thinking, feeling, doing, and see what we need to do. But there is a comma, and there is far more potential that seems that we think we have. And if we tap into that, and believe me, I myself, my journey is obviously, for my experience, has been like that. When I thought I really can't do more, I thought, whoa, no, I can't do more at this level. But when I expand to a higher level, I can do far more and I can know far more. So get curious about more capacity and more knowing and inner wisdom, because there is a lot that is untapped.
Wow. Wow, that's a powerful mic drop right there, Mitra, to end the show on. Mitra, thank you so much for your time and for being on The Ginny Show. I think you've really made me think about what to do, especially with the coconut oil in the morning, but also the having tea. I will never have tea the same way again. I think that will be profoundly changed. But please do tell the good people of The Ginny Show where we can actually find more out about you and your wonderful app that you've got going on and your podcast.
Yes. If you go to innermap, one word, innermap.me or mitramenesh.com, whichever you go, you'll find out. And yes, we have a beautiful app and we have podcasts. I have classes that I do sessions. Everything is there. Just go there and find out for yourself.
Fantastic. Mitra, thank you so much for spending time with me on The Ginny Show. Been an absolute pleasure having you here.
Thank you, Ginny. Stay curious.